Blog Talk Radio.
Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, a spiritual relationship healing expert helping men and women heal their bodies, their relationships, and their lives through love. Author of the book Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, creator of the Complete Relationship System, and director of HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter how old you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with J. Dietrich Stroh, an engineer who founded Stuber Stroh Associations, a civil engineering firm that grew into CSW Stuber Stroh Engineering Group in Novato, California, with offices in Sonoma County as well as Sacramento. He's a director at the Golden Gate Bridge Highway and Transportation District, and he sits on the board of directors of the Bank of Marin. He is active in the community and has sat on many statewide national boards. And in his spare time, he can be found working in his shop on wood projects, restoring cars, and tending to the garden, as well as spending time with friends and family. He lives in Marin County with his wife. He wrote his first book, The Man Who Made It Rain, with Michael McCarthy, during a drought while he was managing the Marin Municipal Water District. And then he had an event in his life, and he has written a second book about that. And this one is called 3 Months, A Caretaker's Journey from Heartbreak to Healing. So I'd like to welcome Dietrich.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you. And I would like to start with, maybe you can explain what happened. You're an engineer, and you think very logically. And then how did you come to write this book that is so different from your background?
Well, it was kind of interesting. After Margaret died, I to get through the grieving process, I guess you'd call it, that I would, in the evenings, I would just write notes about what went on during the 3 months from the time she was diagnosed with cancer, pancreatic cancer, to the time she died. And I just wrote notes about all kinds of stuff, anything from how the cats were reacting to her dying to where she was housed, so to speak, or where her bed was, to what she ate, to almost everything. And the more I wrote about it, the more I started thinking, you know, maybe I'll put this all together in a book form and create a book that others might be able to use in their process of taking care of somebody that's dying. And that's kind of how it got started. And I teamed up with a good friend of mine who is a writer, and we put it together. That's how it happened. It took a couple years to do it, but it helped me grieve. That's one thing that helped.
Wow, I heard you say something that I'm just curious about even before we talk about anything else. You said you wrote about how the cats responded.
Yeah, well,
how
it was
did they respond?
Well, they would spend. We have two cats, and they would spend, when she was in bed, they would spend time on her bed, just watching her, being with her. She was able to pet them. I know that was a great bit of solace for her to be able to do that. She was able to, you know, not kind of talk with them, you might say, and. So it was great comfort for her to have them there. And that it was kind of amazing what they kind of like, they knew, but I don't know if they did, but.
Oh, I think they know. I think animals are extremely sensitive.
Right.
They feel the energy. And one thing I discovered when my mother was dying is that she had electricity all over her body that I felt was like could be used as healing electricity. And cats must feel that.
I think you're probably right.
It's like the energy is moving from the inside of your body to the outside of your body.
Yeah.
That's what it seemed like.
Yeah.
And, wow. So they can be very comforting.
Right, they were.
So this is an amazing book that you put together, and there's so many aspects to caretaking. What was it like for you to write this book?
Well, I still read it now, and I still cry.
So you really wrote it from the heart.
Yes, very
really good. What you were feeling and experiencing.
Yes, exactly. My feelings were coming out. Even though during the process of her dying, they were constantly there, I had the opportunity, or not had the opportunity, it happened that my stepdaughter and Margaret's daughter stayed with me for about 2.5 months and worked with me with her. And we were able to sit at night and talk about what was going on and also talk about history and talk about a lot of other stuff that we just were able to talk to get it out and then be able to, you know, to let the pressure go, so to speak.
I'd like to add, a lot of people don't have that.
No, that's true.
The caretaker is really all alone with the process, and other people are focused mostly on the patient. They're so concerned about the person who has the cancer and is sick, and they don't pay attention to the caretaker.
Well, that's another thing that we write about in the book, about the fact that you're part of the whole system, so to speak, in taking care of someone that's sick, yet you've got a lot of emotions and a lot of stuff going through your head. And you know, the one word that always came to me was hope, H-O-P-E, and I always had hope that she, you know, could turn it around, even though logically I knew that wasn't going to happen. And even once she passed away, the afternoon she passed away, it all came out then.
And I have a question, it's maybe a personal question. As an engineer, usually people are not too emotional. They're very often very intellectual. Were you always emotional, or did this bring it out?
No, I've always been kind of an emotional person. I'm probably an emotional engineer. There aren't too many of them, but
right, that's an unusual combination.
but
that enabled you to write the book.
Yeah, I think so. I could set it aside, so to speak, the emotions aside, but also at the same time feel it, cry, and laugh, and hug, and do all the good things we do as human beings. And as an engineer, it just, that helped me get through the fact that, you know, the technical portions, the shots that she had to take, the pills we had to give her, pardon me, and making sure she had the right prescriptions and the taking temperatures and doing all the things a nurse would do, so to speak, that you kind of put that all together. And another thing she had was the fact that her digestive system had blocked up, and so they had done a bypass of and I had to take care of that. She sat on the potty and took care of it and cleaned it and that type of thing. In fact, at one time she was doing that, sitting on the potty, and I was cleaning the bag out. She looked at me laughingly and said, "You know what you're doing?" And I says, "Well, do you want to do it?" And she said, no, you're doing okay." So there was humor.
I get out of that is talk about intimacy.
That's right.
And that's like the ultimate intimacy.
We think, like
sexual intercourse is intimacy. This is, you know, when you're really dealing with people when they're not shining.
Well, you're right. But you just do it. I don't know how else to explain it. You just do it, and we were pretty darn close. And the interesting thing about it was that bag that she had. She was a very fastidious person, and I thought, oh man, she's going to have a problem with this. But she took it. She just took it along with her stride, and we both did. So it was kind of interesting.
Well, it sounds as if she had qualities that were really wonderful, and that's why you loved her.
Oh gosh, yeah.
And it came out even when she was ill.
Are
there some other moments that stand out?
Well, I think one of the obviously the main moment was when we were told in December, just before Christmas, that she had pancreatic cancer and didn't look good. That was really what was being said to us, and we were intelligent people enough, and we read enough stuff that we knew that this was going to be serious, unbelievably serious, and we cried and we hugged and we did all this stuff at that point in time. And but that was a defining moment. Another one was when it turned out that she couldn't eliminate, and had to do a bypass on her digestive tract. That was probably the third one was the month before she died. We were sitting in the hospital. She was laying in the hospital, and we talked about, well, should we come home or should we try to go through chemo again or what have you. And I looked at her and I says, what do you think? And she says, what do you think? And I says, I think we should go home. And she says, I think we should. And that was it. That was the end.
Did she stop the chemo at that time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. That had been stopped because she, in the middle of all this business, she got staph infection. And she had to get thrown back in the hospital. Damn near died from that.
I'm finding that's a pretty common thing nowadays. These infections add to the problem.
That's right. That's right. She spent 10 days just recovering from that. That's when, after that happened, that's when we went home.
Well, one of the things that my friend who's taking a lot of chemotherapy said, I gave her a session on the table. I did this gentle Rubenfeld Synergy method to get in touch with emotions and feelings. And what she was saying is that she's not so much fighting the cancer as she's also fighting the chemicals in her body.
Yeah. Yeah,
because
yeah.
It weakens your body. It weakens the cancer cells, but it also weakens your immune system.
You know, I've one of the things I've come to conclusion about, and probably all wet, but at least this is my opinion, and that is, if in fact you have stage four pancreatic cancer, which is the big one, so to speak. Once you have stage four, very few people survive it, and people go through a tremendous amount of chemo and radiation and all kinds of stuff like that and suffer through that, and then they still pass away. And my conclusion is kind of live it out. In other words, don't go through it. But that's probably...
That's interesting because there's another lady that I had interviewed on the radio show that was dying of cancer and refused to take any kind of chemotherapy or radiation, and she was blogging about it.
There
She's
you go.
She's Ukraine Bakos.
Yeah,
and
I know.
I was very impressed that she's keeping track, and she seems to have stopped writing. You know, she was getting sicker and sicker, but she was not taking the chemo.
Well, that's it. It just adds to the quotes. At least it adds. Margaret went through a couple sessions with it, and it got pretty bad. And that's when they found out she wasn't eliminating or heavy. So it all got mixed up, but never went back to it. But I firmly feel that the quality of life or quality of dying, if that's the right word, is more important than trying to think you can beat it. You're not going to beat it. It's just unfortunate. You know, people try. I have a good friend that just spent 18 months going through chemo and all kinds of stuff, and he just passed away this week. So, you know... And he had pancreatic cancer.
Mm.
So, anyway, it wasn't easy.
No, it's not easy. And so I have a question. What aspects of your role as a caregiver most significantly affected your life and maybe your work, and did it affect your work?
I don't know. The work was a way of getting away from it, so to speak, not really getting away because you're still thinking about it. It really didn't affect it as much as I wasn't around as much. I wasn't able to take care of stuff. Projects and other folks here had to step in and take care of the things I was working on because of the fact I was spending time with her and to take her to the hospital or whatever I was doing. But How do you manage it? Do you just kind of work around it? People, you know, what's interesting, your friends, your relatives, and everybody else during these times really come together and really try to help. And they may not want to be directly involved, but they're willing to step up and help you, you know, get through whatever you need to do.
So how did they help you?
Let them do it.
Like, in what ways did people help you?
Well, like I say, the people would pick up the projects that I was working on and work to take care of them for me.
Oh, okay.
And other ways, the simple stuff, going to grocery store, going taking care of errands that need to be taken care of. And that's one of the things I found. Let them do it. Don't try to...
Well, what I would find is that some caretakers don't have friends helping them out like that, because maybe they're staunch about it. They don't even tell anyone that they need the help.
Well, that's another thing I learned. Let everybody know. And they'll come forward. They'll come, what can I do? What can I do? And there were more care packages, you might say, were brought to the house or to the hospital. She was in the hospital from her friends. Funny little things, like one woman brought her socks. I don't know what she thought she needed socks for, but she brought socks.
Well, oh, that's sweet, though.
yeah. Well, it was her way of saying, hey, I love you, you know?
I think the socks were to keep her feet warm.
Oh, I know that, but I mean...
but just to, like, a comfort to keep your feet warm.
Yeah, exactly. Right on.
Instead of hospital socks.
Yeah. That's right.
So how did you keep a positive attitude? Because it seems like you made that effort. You made her laugh sometimes.
Well, that was the other piece of it. We when she was not ill, there was always a sense of humor that was floating back and forth between us. And we kind of knew what each other was thinking, type of stuff. And so this was a positive thing that we continued doing that. As an example, 3 days before she passed away, my stepdaughter, and we did have a lady come in, help out once in a while, as far as sponge bathing her in the bed and what have you. And she was laying completely nude there, and I walked into the bedroom, stood at the end of the bed, and Margaret put her head up and said to me, "What are you doing here, you dirty old man?" Being a dirty old man. And you know, everybody laughed. It was just to break the tension, the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of not similar stuff, but things like that. We, in those last days, she didn't talk much. And we had movies and stuff that she loved to watch. I don't know if she understood them, but at least she had a little, somewhat of a smile on her face. And so you find ways of keeping a positive attitude. You know that inevitable is coming, and you start doing things that you're going to have to take care of afterwards. So you don't have a positive attitude, you're going to crack up.
So when you say things you have to take care of, like what did you?
Well,
what kind
we started.
Of things were
I
you
started,
handling at that time?
I had been through already in my life. I lost two sisters and lost my mother and father. And had done all the work, not work, but the arrangements for the mortuary and all that stuff. So I'd already put together things that I needed to do in my own mind. And this art, I knew darn well I'd have to take care of after she passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the engineer side of me.
Right. So you have an organized side. Yeah, some
yes,
caretakers... don't have that. They're not organized, and they can't think, and they're all emotional. So that's where leaning on somebody else can be very helpful.
Yes, that's very true. And I think sometimes it's like Donna, my stepdaughter, or whoever was there, a friend or what have you, they would suggest something. I'd say, oh, I never thought of that. Well, that's a good idea, you know, that type of thing.
So you're reminding me that it's real important for a caretaker to not isolate themselves.
Oh, yes.
That's one of the things that happens, though. If you don't have a lot of close family and friends, you can get very isolated. And
well,
it's so
yeah,
hard to handle.
thought it is. It would be very difficult to handle. I don't think I could have probably handled it that way. I wouldn't have handled it that way anyway. I would have reached out to whatever friends I may have, and I have a lot. And I have the office. I have those people in it. And everybody was aware of what was going on. I would give a kind of a little news report to the 40 people that work here, the staff, and keep them apprised of what went on that day or the day before or whatever. The lady that comes in and paints the fingernails, they had her come over and do Margaret's nails.
Thought of something. When someone is in a hospital, they don't let you have your nails done.
That's right.
They take that away from you. They remove the nail polish, and you don't have makeup on, and it can be so demoralizing.
One of the first things that Margaret did in the morning, while she still was able to, is brush her hair, and then afterwards, Donna would brush her hair, and then she would just kind of just perk up when that happened.
Yeah, we don't realize how these small things can mean so much. My mother was dying, it was like, I don't know, just a few days before she died, my brother was coming from Wisconsin to New Jersey to see her, and the most important thing to her was that she could be sitting up in a chair when he got there.
Right, exactly.
You'd think who cares, but it meant so much to her.
Well,
and she was so happy to be in a chair.
Yep, and we had two, I don't know how we ended up with two wheelchairs, but we did. But anyway, I'd get Margaret in a wheelchair with a robe on and all the stuff with the head of the blanket. And we would roll outside and look at her garden. She had a rhododendron garden, and she loved to look at the flowers and the rhododendrons and everything else. And we'd push her around. She liked to sit in the sun. She totally enjoyed that.
That's wonderful. And so she was at home a lot. She wasn't always in the hospital.
No, she was only in the hospital twice. And one was when she had surgery to put the bypass in, and the second time was a staph infection. So altogether, maybe in the 3 months, she was in the hospital 2 weeks.
Okay, so after she had the staph infection, when she was better, you just brought her home.
That's right.
Okay, so she had some really good qualities. Like when my mother was dying, my stepfather could not bring her home. He was too emotional. He just could not handle it. So
you know,
not everybody can handle being a caretaker at home.
Well, I guess I was lucky from the standpoint that our relationship was so close that I didn't think there was any alternative. I would not leave her in the hospital. There was no way.
That's beautiful. So how did it progress? Tell a little bit about what was happening toward the end. How did you know it at the time or whatever?
That's the saddest part, is to watch a person go from, quotes, a healthy person, rosy cheeks to everything looking good, and then all of a sudden, not sudden, but over a period of time, lose a lot of weight. She was literally skin and bones when she died. Her eyes were glazed most of the time. She was on painkillers, but it was interestingly enough, methadone. And so we had to constantly give her that once in a while, a morphine, but she was on anti-nausea stuff. So, in some ways, when I say she was, she was on drugs, and the only way she, I guess you'd call it, survive, because she hated the pain and she hated the being nauseated. So we were very cautious and very careful on how we administered that, making sure she was okay. But she basically, you might call it, disappeared on me, body-wise, physically. She got so thin, so emaciated, and she would, maybe in any given day, she would recognize everybody for maybe an hour off and on, but that was about it.
And was anyone giving her shots of put sugar into your system?
No, we didn't have to do shots. She was able to take the methadone by pills, and the other stuff by drops, and but very little of that. And the day she died, actually, I was at a meeting, and my stepdaughter called, and she was administering her at the noontime medicines, and she was in her kind of leaning up against Donna in bed, and basically took a couple deep breaths, and then she was gone, just like that.
And were you there, or you were?
No, they called me at that point in time, and you know, you say silly stuff, like I said, okay, I'll be there, I'll be right there. It took me about half an hour to get home. But on the way home, I said, I wonder if they know what they're talking about. So I called them, called Donna up, and I said, are you sure? Are you sure she died? You know, and you got that crazy hope. And well, she was dead. And so I went in and kissed her and covered her up.
So what an emotional experience.
Oh, yeah.
So now I have a question. In the 3 years that have passed, and you seem to have been able to move forward in your life. What happened? How did you cope?
Well,
how have you coped, and what came to pass?
I went, you know, as I said, I was writing writing all these notes, and slowly but surely, I didn't realize it myself that I was actually emotionally getting better, let's call it. And one morning I got up and I said, God, I feel different. I don't feel empty anymore. I feel something's missing. I just finally realized that I had gone through the end of I'd gotten through it. And it just so happened that part of it, to keep busy and what have you, I was going to the particular meetings once a month that I'm involved with professionally, and there happened to be a lady, and don't ask me why, but we used to sit next to each other because I guess we just kind of enjoyed each other's company. So anyway, a couple of months after this grieving thing, I was through with it, so to speak. I wasn't in there. You never get through with it, but at least I could live with it. And I'm sitting there next to her in one of these meetings, and I wonder if she'd go out to dinner with me. And so I screwed up my courage and asked her out. Well, we're now married. So that it helps that you go through it. And I think it's best explained to me that someone who has a good marriage and a solid marriage will marry very soon after losing somebody. Not very soon, but, you know, not waiting years.
Well, because you know how wonderful a relationship can be.
That's right.
And you also know how to, you love. You have love in your heart, so you can love another person.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, people say to me, how could you do that? And I says, look, this is history. It's history now. I can't bring her back. I couldn't. There's no way that's going to happen. And to sit in a room with all the lights out and brooding about it, that doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't do me any good, and my children, it doesn't do my children any good. And I've got 7 grandchildren, and it doesn't do them any good. And they've all accepted my new wife, and my new wife understands perfectly. She's, in fact, read the book, and she understands it just like I do. That's history. So that's kind of the way I look at it.
So is there any important message you'd like to give to other caretakers from your book?
I think a couple of things. One, the book hopefully shows that you need to reach out to others and to get some help. Don't try to do it all yourself. It's not going to work. You're going to ground yourself into a nothing. I think that's one piece of it. The other is, it's okay to cry. It's okay to laugh. It's okay to feel your emotions, and especially with the person that's dying. It's okay to kid them. It's okay to kind of wake them up, so to speak. Just don't sit there with a long face. Start laughing about things or crying. And one of the biggest things I found very much solace in was hug my friends.
Wow, Dietrich. You are such a gift to men, because men need to hear this. There are many that feel that way, but they're ashamed, or, you know, and they don't support each other to just feel the emotion. So Jason, well, thank you so much.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I was so happy to be here.
Our time is ending. So I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, healthybabyboomersnetwork.com, to get your free report, How to Live to 100 and Beyond. And find my Reawakening Love chapter in the book Adventures in Manifesting at createhealingandlovenow.com/manifesting.htm. And if you want to schedule an appointment or a counseling session or a coaching session, go to drericawellness.com.